Okay, so it's the, what, the 19th of March, right? 20th, see? 20th of March, 2013. And we've been talking a lot about relationships, right? Especially the kind of down and dirty aspects of it. Like, what do you do when they want something you don't want? Or you want something they don't want? Or they talk in the wrong way? Or they leave the toilet seat up? Or whatever it is. We went through a lot of examples. And I want to try to get at an angle on relationship stuff from a particular perspective, walk through it with you, and then more open it up for discussion, all right? And so to do that, I'd like to read a few passages to you, generally from the Dhammapada. These are short passages, and by the way, if you would like to connect with, if you haven't already, an organization called Pariyatti, they will send you an email every day. It's their dana to you, their generosity to you, that has a quote for the day. And they're just great. So that's where these are coming from. So here's the first one I'd like to offer to you. Impermanent are all compounded things. When one perceives this with true insight, then one becomes detached from suffering. This is the path of purification. So, impermanent are all compounded things. When one perceives this with true insight, then one becomes free of suffering. And seeing this is a path of purification. Those four lines are very fundamental. And people who traditionally, when Buddhism was in its first few centuries, who would repeat these lines would be self-identified as, okay, I'm practicing in the way of the Buddha. In other words, anything that is caused to arise will be caused to pass away. So I want to examine our issues in relationships through the lens of impermanence, which is a very fundamental teaching in Buddhism. And related to that, an associated teaching, which is implicit in impermanence, which is the teaching of emptiness. That things, it's not that there's only void or nothing exists, but rather the nature of everything is empty of any kind of absolute self-existence. Everything is conditionally arising, dependent upon everything else. So I want to read a couple other quotes that are along these lines. So he says here, above, across, or back again, wherever one goes in the world, let one carefully scrutinize the rise and fall of compounded things. Above, across, or back again, wherever one goes in the world, let one carefully scrutinize the rise and fall of compounded things. And that sounds really abstract, because partly it is, but let's bring it down to earth. He's talking here about observing changes outside ourselves. People walk into the room. People walk out of the room, right? Babies are born. Babies grow up. Babies leave home. People pass away. Irritating conditions change. Things that were going well stop going well. You know, things change around us. And also, in particular, he's really talking about our own phenomenology. In other words, our own interior, if you will, experience of things. They seem out there, right? You seem out there for me. But the sight of you, much as your sight of me, is continually constructed internally in a kind of virtual way. One way to appreciate how virtual the inner world is, how constructed it is in the simulator, if you'll do this with me, if you don't mind. So imagine looking at me roughly through a tube about yay big, okay? Probably about 4 inches in diameter, roughly. So you're looking out, okay, you all look rather comical, but anyway. Okay, so you kind of got a visual on that, you see? Now, outside of the field of that tube, if you will, does it look like it's in color? Right? It seems like it's in color, doesn't it, outside that little tube? And then also, outside that tube, it's fairly sharp, correct? It's not in the absolute focus of your view, but it's pretty sharp. Okay, you can lower your... Well, the way the retina works is that the rods and cones that produce color vision are only in the center of the focal of the visual field. Everything outside that center is black and white. But we don't see black and white outside of that central tube, do we? It's CG'd in. It's computer graphicked in, as it were. It's totally virtual. In the same way, if you could see what's outside this field, it would be extremely blurred. Except the brain is continually constructing, it's correcting for those distortions. Again, it's constructing it virtually. And of course, what we see is just a tiny fraction, I think it's roughly less than 1%, of the total electromagnetic spectrum. So, you know, what the Buddha talks here about compounded things rising and passing away, very much he's talking about our actual experience of things. And that's a radical and very liberating move to bring it into our own sights and sounds, tastes, touches, smells, and then thoughts, to kind of bring it in here. Because when it's out there, things look very stuck, don't they? Kind of brick-like. Like they seem to change slowly. But when we bring it in here and we relate to the sight of the event or the thing rather than the thing itself, the sound of the thing rather than the thing itself as we imagine it, because, of course, we never experience it directly. When we come in here into our own experiencing, then we have radical opportunities to become very, very free. So that's the move he continually encourages us to make. I read a book recently, I recommend it, called What the Buddha Thought by Richard Gombrich, an Oxford professor of Sanskrit studies, whatever. And he said the Buddha had no interest per se in the world. He had no interest in the world per se. He had no interest in the world as the world. He was strictly interested in our experience of the world. Okay. So one more quote here. He says, better it is to live one day seeing the rise and fall of things than to live 100 years without ever seeing the rise and fall of things. So to the extent that it interests you to do this, the essence of Buddhist practice is to scrutinize the rise and fall of compounded things. In other words, to recognize impermanence and to have that recognition be increasingly in real time and granular, so that increasingly we start seeing things changing, in other words, ending or disappearing, as well as emerging very kind of rapidly and close to this moment, with a sense of that happening with regard to smaller and smaller units of experience. We practice concentration by focusing on the breath or sustaining an open, spacious awareness either way to sharpen our acuity of perception into impermanence. Because it's on the basis of that, in his teaching, that we get to radically liberating insight. We eventually see the transience of things. We see things changing so quickly that we really recognize in our bones the futility of chasing after experiences, trying to hold on to them in any way. So it's a practice around impermanence. Okay. And then the last quote, and then I'll talk about relationships. He says, to avoid all evil, to cultivate good, and to purify one's mind, this is the teaching of the Buddhas. To avoid all evil, to cultivate good, and to purify one's mind. And I find when I sometimes get too complex about all this stuff, I come back to actually that quote. Avoid evil, broadly defined, work on that. Cultivate the good, take in the good, cultivate the good. I can work on that. That sounds more fun than avoid all evil, but all right, do that. And to purify the mind increasingly. You know, let things kind of clear the clouds out of it, see more and more clearly. All right, that sounds pretty good. In other words, that is the practice of seeing impermanence. So how to bring it into relationships, right? I thought about this kind of from two perspectives. One perspective is out there. So for one, it's interesting how much of the time we get into conflicts or struggles with people when actually, if we took a broader view, more of a long-term view, and we had more of an awareness of how these conditions that are irksome are changing, then we wouldn't be so bothered by them. So, you know, you might want to think about a significant relationship or something that's bothering you, and think about it in terms of things changing. Conditions are changing in it. Even the people that are bothersome, pardon me, they're changing too. And eventually they will pass away. They will minimally leave home or retire or, you know, move on to something else. There are changes that are occurring there. You know, what happens when you look at things that bug you in relationships through the lens of how things are continually changing? Any comment about that? I can be annoyed, you know, by the sounds outside the room, right? Bring it down to earth. But then you realize, it'll change. They'll move along. You know, time will pass. Eventually this it'll be over. You know, things change. Things move on. I think myself about trouble I've gotten into with family members, because I just got really caught up in this moment, you know? This moment when I came home and the house was messier than I hoped it was. Or this moment when, you know, our kids had some kind of attitude and I was caught up in, you know, not placing it in the context of just being teenagers, moving on, time changing, you know? Times I've been disappointed at something that I wanted to have happen tonight. And it didn't happen tonight, but the not happening of it changed the next night when it did happen and I got what I wanted. See examples like that? So that's one bit. You know, looking out there, seeing changes. The other thing I want to mention in terms of looking out there, that for me is a takeaway from the Buddha's teachings about impermanence, is to ask yourself, do the causes and conditions really promote what I want? Or am I trying to grow roses in a parking lot? Am I trying to get blood from a stone? Am I trying to take a duck to eagle school, as they say? That's a saying from sales, but anyway. Never send a duck to eagle school, but anyway. Will that dog hunt? Think of all those examples. In other words, I ask myself sometimes, you know, I'm trying to get something to happen, but in terms of the rise and the fall of compounded things, are the compounded things actually present? Or alternately, how could I get them going? How could I, as Ajahn Chah, Jack Kornfield's teacher, put it, how could I tend to the causes? Rather than getting agitated about the results that are not happening, how could I cultivate more causes? This tree's not giving me any fruit. Well, maybe it needs some more water, or a different kind of water, or less water. Maybe I'm overwatering it. You know, how could I tend to the causes out here so that I could encourage different kinds of compounded things to come into being? One of my own, a couple of very important insights in my own family had to do with realizing that as rational as it was, and it was rational, to want what I wanted, and the other person agreed that it was rational, the truth was, the conditions were just not present in that person's mind. It just wasn't going to happen. They couldn't hold. They couldn't hold it together. And me continuing to try to get that thing was just swimming upstream. Different things had to happen for there to be a different result, including, in some cases, the passage of time. So you want to ask yourself, okay, what causes could I tend to, right? If I'm not getting what I want, maybe I need to create different causes out there. Or maybe I need to realize that it's just not going to happen. The very first book I wrote, Mother Nurture, was about the long-term care of mothers in mind, body, and intimate relationships. And it's a very well-written book. It's full of good information. I wrote it with my wife, who's a nutritionist. I wrote it with a third person, who's a OBGYN MD. It, you know, looked really good. Penguin published it. Christiane Northrup endorsed it. And it was growing roses in a parking lot. Came out soon after 9/11. I have three strikes against me. I'm male. I'm not an academic, and I'm not an MD. And the fourth strike is that most mothers are not interested in taking care of themselves. There's no market for the book. Everybody, the handful of people who read it, 7,500 of them, said, great book, you know. But the conditions just weren't there. On the other hand, 3.5 years ago, when Buddha's Brain came out, it was explosive. It was like a phenomenal wave just sweeping me along, for which I'm very, very grateful. The point is the conditions were different. I think both books are, they're both well-written, they're both substantive, same author, but but the results completely different. And I think sometimes we just struggle, but the conditions are just not there. The causes and conditions are just not there for what we want. Okay? So then, coming in here, and this is where I want to kind of go more radical. So, two things. When we look in here, in terms of the teachings of impermanence and emptiness and the compounded nature of things, the first thing to ask ourselves that I suggest, or a thing one could ask oneself, is what causes are present in my own mind with regard to this thing? And how could I tend to, how could I cultivate different causes inside my own mind about this thing? Maybe I want something from my partner or at work, but it's hard for me to actually say it or to stay with it in the face of some any kind of resistance or not getting the message. What inside myself could I cultivate? What factors could I get going inside my own mind that would help me in that regard? How could I build up strengths inside, factors inside that would take care of this? Or maybe alternately, something is inside me that's a problem in relationships. Maybe I like to eat too much or drink too much or talk too much or interrupt too much or opine about politics too much or watch too much TV, whatever. What inside me would help me manage that better if it were present? So what causes can I cultivate inside myself? You know, if your mind is like a garden, basically, you can witness it, you can pull weeds, or you can plant flowers. That's it. Or you can transcend the garden altogether. But inside the frame of the garden, what are we going to do? We can watch it, reduce the negative, increase the positive. So you can ask yourself, okay, what could I cultivate? What compounded things could I cause to come into being inside my own mind, or what could I encourage to pass away? One thing for myself that I've really encouraged to pass away, starting 4 or 5-ish probably years ago, was I've really encouraged anger to pass out of my mind. I think there's a place for fierceness, for outrage, for fieriness, for strength. And I think sometimes anger is your least bad option, okay? It's an intermediate method. But to the extent you can, to allow ill will to pass out of your mind, to still see distinctions, to not be pushed around, not be a doormat, not walk on eggshells, but to encourage anger to pass out of your mind. And I personally began outside in, because that's sometimes how you have to begin. I took a personal vow never to speak or act out of anger, especially in my family. And I was not an angry guy particularly, but when I took that personal vow, and I meant it completely, I meant not one atom or a quantum particle of anger speaking or acting. I could feel it, but I wouldn't speak or act from it. See the distinction? I'm not talking about shutting down your emotions. I'm talking about eventually, internally, it just is not there anymore, okay? Or it's harder and harder to trigger. But I'm starting outside. And when I began doing that, it was really interesting. I caught myself being angry, you know, a dozen times that first day. And they were small, right? A little bit of exasperation, a little bit of eye roll, you know, a little bit of snippiness, some tone, quick gesture. Really? You know, stuff like that. Come on. You know, that kind of thing. Or grosser forms, I'm ashamed to say. And I went, wow. But, you know, gradually, increasingly, not a lot of speaking or acting from anger going on in a genuine way. So you might ask yourself what you could cultivate differently inside your own mind. But then here's the radical part. And it's very simple. It's a little bit like the meditation today, in a way. It's very simple, but that doesn't mean it's easy. And it doesn't, and it's simple, and it's also very, very profound. And it's this. It's to consider or contemplate your own experience, the anger at that person, the hurt, the belief about the meaning, the interpretation, whatever it is, the sound of their voice, the startle when you're doing something and their voice comes into your space, right? To consider all of that, the rationales that arise for why I'm right and you're wrong, right? All that. To consider all of it deeper than content, to almost ignore the content, and to look at it just as an experience. And as an experience, to kind of see it at the wallpaper level, at the pixel level inside your own mind, and recognize that that experience you're having, like all experiences, is empty. It's as if you look down to the level of your own experience. Imagine a tapestry. If you're 10 feet back, it looks like, you know, the dragon and the princess and the knight in shining armor and the king and the peasants and the houses and the flames and whatever, right? But when you get up real close, all you see are threads. And you get even closer, all you see are little fibers in the threads. It's like that with your own experience that I'm talking about here. You get so close, you just recognize it's just fibrous threads. It's just colored threads. And it's insubstantial and quivering and vibrating and humming and changing so rapidly. What's the problem? Simple, right? It's simple, but it's not so easy to sustain. Because it's funny, what happens sometimes is we have this, when we start doing it, we kind of get it, and then we start commenting on it. And as soon as we comment on it, we reify it, right? And we also have this sort of observer entity, and we're out of it again. But the observer entity is just another experience. That's really powerful. The sense of being the executive, or the observer, the agent, the chooser, or the owner of experiences, the I, in other words, I is just another experience. It's just more phenomenology. It just thinks it's the ultimate badass on the tapestry. It's the king of the whole thing. It actually thinks it's the painter, right? The weaver. But it's just another collection of threads. That's very radical, but totally cool and freeing. And it takes you right into the essence of the Dharma. What do you think about this?
It seems to me that what you're suggesting is that we can control, if you will, what we do inside, how we perceive. We cannot control. on the outside, using that word very loosely and inelegantly there. So if we work on what we have some chance of changing, our success is much more likely to achieve what we want in terms of harmony in a relationship, less aggravation, not expressing anger, or whatever it is that we choose to deliberately intention and manifest in our life.
Yeah. So I hope you heard what Jillie said. She said, are you saying, Rick, essentially that we should focus, in a sense, on our own psyches and influencing that rather than influencing other beings? And my personal opinion is that's not what I'm trying to say. And in other words, I am saying that I think it's true that we imagine that there are other people over there, okay? Like, I think it's almost certainly true that you exist. I hope you're glad that I'm willing to extend that to you, right?
Delighted.
Okay, I think almost certainly this chair exists, okay? This wall. But I also accept the fact, radically, that I cannot prove it and I'll never encounter it fully directly. We only engage the world mediated by this ongoing constructed process of our phenomenology, our experiencing. That's just true, I think. So both being compassionate, what's the point of compassion if there's no other? There must be an other for there to be a point to compassion, right? There must be an other for there to be a point to restraint of ill will. There must be an other to, if there's any point in individual karma, individual fruits of actions. So there's kind of a misunderstanding that's crept in to a certain amount of Buddhism, at least, that it's all one. Well, in some ultimate sense, there's only allness. But inside that, there's a lot of differentiation. So for me, it's utterly appropriate to regard that Jillie is as existent as Rick is. She has a body that exists. The pain in her toothache is in her mouth, not mine, okay? On the other hand, if I have too many cookies, it doesn't make her fat. I had a psychotic client once, a young woman, who psychotically believed that when she walked by a restaurant, the food that other people were eating was going into her body. So, in other words, she didn't get the differentiation. So on the one hand, I should recognize Jillie is there, and if there's something that's important that I need, it's perfectly appropriate for me to influence that real being over there, that real person over there, while always simultaneously knowing that fundamentally I'm influencing something in my own experience. So both are true. So to me, but that said, we also recognize that our influence over the real beings over there really is very limited. We do what we can, we take our best shot, right? But after a while we realize, what are the causes and conditions? You know, is that person fundamentally going to keep the most important agreement in relationships, which is to keep their agreements? They agree to keep their agreements or not. You know, is this person fundamentally reliable or not, you know, over there? That's kind of what I'm trying to say. But what do you think about the last thing I worked my way to? This idea of, if you're upset about something or bothered about something, you know, or anything that's going on that's at all problematic, that experience, like sweet and wonderful experiences, is fundamentally deconstructed down to the level of colored threads. Yeah.
Well, it seems like you're saying that when you come, anger rises up, be identified with it's I'm angry.
Yeah.
It's not the anger. But it's in that moment when you have to be able to pause somehow.
Yeah.
And have a practice, right? To be able to see it as something that's just another experience, like being happy that way.
Right. Yeah. And then the question, of course, and I think this is, in a way, I'm the messenger for what I at least conceive of as the Dharma. And the Buddha is saying look closely at that experience and see if you can tease it apart into its threads. When you say anger arises, well, what are the body sensations? And then what are the elements even of those body sensations? What are the emotions? And even the witness to the anger, that too is an experience. What are the threads of that experience?
You know. So when you went through your vows,
and so still in them.
The first day, 12 times. How long? What did it process till you were able to actually begin to pause on some of them?
I'll get into real time with it.
Yeah, but you know.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of being able to catch it.
It happened pretty quickly because I was really embarrassed internally. You know what I mean? I didn't tell anybody. But I was at the time, I was internally embarrassed. I couldn't believe how often I was in some way exasperated or irritated. And I think in fairness, so someone would regard me toward the very low end of the distribution of, you know, angry dads. But even that, it was kind of horrifying. So that motivated me right quick, you know, to get a grip. So that it was pretty fast, actually, in that. But I think that's where foundation practices like mindfulness training can really help out. All right. So what do you think of what I'm saying about this tapestry idea? Yeah.
I love the whole tapestry thing. It's just phenomenal.
Phenomenology, phenomenal, right? There we are.
Go on.
Yeah.
I relate so much to the metaphor, and then when I try and think about practicing in that metaphor, one of the things that comes up for me is being in your experience while still being present and relating to other.
Yeah.
And so I'm just kind of musing on that.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. One thing that I've been doing lately, and invite you into it, is to kind of, two things really. One is to be aware of what I call the wallpaper of experience. It's like the background. So we're experiencing things. We're having sights. You're having them right now. You can try it right now. Even the meanings of the language that's being used here. And ask yourself, wow, why am I having the kind of experiences I'm having? I don't mean, why am I having sensation in my tush as I sit in the chair. I mean, why does the sensation of the tush feel like that? And you start realizing how arbitrary it is. Why does sitting on a chair, why does tush pressure feel like tush pressure? Right? Like, why does a pretzel taste like pretzel? Why does chocolate, why? It's arbitrary. Take a breath, you know? Like, the actual nature of the experience, it's just constructed. It's the result of 600 million years of evolution of the nervous system, right? Especially the last several million. It's just made up. And then you kind of go, wow, the thisness of experience, the like-thisness of experience, the wallpaper of it, you start realizing is so made up, and yet we take it so seriously. And you start recognizing how constructed our own experience is, and it becomes increasingly non-binding. You know, it doesn't carry us along so much. You know what I'm talking about? Yeah. Sort of. It's a trippy thing to try to zero in on your experience, not in its particulars, but its underlying qualities. And then see that those qualities have this fizzy, insubstantial, granular nature, because they're kind of just continually invented.
So what comes up for me about it, Rick, is the beauty of the tapestry, or trying to find the wallpaper, mm-hmm. but also very, very quickly that the business of the observer and the judgment or the mm-hmm. organize, you know, what does the tapestry look like? I mean, it's just feels like there's some tension there, and getting to the total experience of the tapestry in the way that you're describing it, I see as a goal. But I think it's still it's just practice, right? I mean, to continue practicing it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. I'll use it. I read this piece recently from this Tibetan Lama. And this actually, he quoted a very, I can't unfortunately remember the name, a Tibetan teacher lived around the 8th century. It's three things to what you just said there. The first thing is, it's really two statements. The first statement is, like, vision, and it could be anything, sight, sound, taste, touch, smell, you know, the six sense doors, or a thought, emotion, desire, internal criticism, sense of observing ego, all that. I'll call it mental content. The first step is mental content, like vision, sight, image. Image. Image is mind. He's saying, and he's pointing to an experience. You might get it initially conceptually, but you go to an experience. Image is mind. Thought is mind. Sight is mind. Sound is mind. Taste is mind. Sense of inner critic is mind. Anger is mind. Resolve to not speak from anger. Mind. So, in other words, he's saying that the picture, in my metaphor, is tapestry. Kind of radically, qualitatively, categorically. So you become increasingly disengaged from the imagery on the tapestry, you know, the sight, the sound, the taste, the touch, the smell, the image, and you just become more and more involved with tapestry-ness, mind-ness. Image is mind. That's the first step in this teaching. And then the one after that is mind is empty. Even mind, this underlying process, I think of it myself as a neuro guy, as the representing, processing, happening in the underlying neuropsychological substrates. It's this dynamic representational process that's representing information. It's representing a whole architecture of information, the tip of which, above the threshold of awareness, is this moment of sound, image, self-criticism, what have you. Okay? So mind itself is empty. Mind itself is process. Mind itself arises dependently. Mind itself has this insubstantiality in it. And you kind of go, wow, if image is mind and mind is empty, you know, it's like the bottom falls out of everything, except there's still an ongoingness, right? And that goes to what I was going to say a moment ago. You know, I'll take the comment, and then we'll move to a wrap. That, so as I said, one thing to do in practice is to start recognizing the kind of the wallpaper itself, or the tapestry-ness itself, or mind itself, right? And then another thing to do is to, in effect, just be the tapestry. Just be mind. Be you know, as they say, be emptiness rolling along. You know, be mind. And it's hard. As soon as you notice your mind, then you're out of mind. You're observing, being mind. Mm-hmm. You know, you're no longer tapestry. You're no longer ground. You're figure looking at ground, right? Wishing you were back in ground. And then a little later, you find yourself ground again. You're just being tapestry. You're being mind. But increasingly, and I think that's what people do in practice. When you read the accounts of people who are very, very, very far along, to me, that's what they're talking about. Shinzen Young described this once, and it was very helpful to me. He said, normally, we have this experience that we're the figure looking at the ground, and the ground being, let's say, allness. And then at certain moments, we might have a very strong experience of switching, and then we're ground looking at figure. In effect, we're allness looking at partness. And increasingly, we start having an intuition that moves into our everyday experiencing of that allness, that mind, if you will. And then applying that into relationships, right? Seeing more and more that their face that's bothersome, that image, that angry look on his face or her face, right, that's got me going, that dismissive little in their face is actually an experience strictly in me, and it is mind, and mind is empty. Like when you do that and it's authentic, it like really moves the stress needle back down to resting. Because like, how agitated can you get, right, about something empty constructed inside your own head? Kumbaya. How about, sorry, let's just talk afterward. Let's just sit for a minute, okay? You do it with the sounds of the music, just kind of the wallpaperness of it, you know, the just phenomena. Being the tapestry, there's no problem. It's when we set ourselves apart from things like the music or resist it, then there's a problem. I mean, this teaching is really about being in life, being in one's life. Thinking of Dogen's comment, you know, that to study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And to forget the self is to be illuminated by, or to be enlivened by, or lived by all things. We kind of empty out into allness. I'm very grateful to being able to go with you on these journeys to pretty far out places. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rick. You know, as what's his name? Ajahn Jumnian says, empty, empty, happy, happy. Empty, empty, happy, happy. That's just what he says. Empty, empty, happy, happy. All right.
I'm